The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. We're ready to hear argument in our first case, 11-1747, In re Maharaj. Mr. Press?
Yes, good morning. May it please the court, I'm Dan Press, appearing as amicus here in support of the appellant on behalf of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys.
Not to put any pressure on anybody's oral argument, tell you the panel is struggling with this case, so we're really hopeful that you all can help us today.
Well, I'm here to try, Judge. Let me start by pointing out the case. I hope the court has had a chance to see the Friedman opinion that was filed with a 28-J letter the other day. That decision came down on Monday of this week.
Not unanimous, and just further seeds, I think, that the concerns that we have about the interpretation of the statute.
Well, and it was not. You're absolutely right. It was not unanimous. It was a 2-1 decision. And but I would point out that both Friedman and the other appellate level, of course, this is a bankruptcy, typically a 3-level appellate process. The Biggins case out of the Middle District of Florida, both of those cases found that the plain meaning analysis supported the abrogation of the absolute priority rule with regard to individual debtors, as in this case. And I think that's where, of course, you start any statutory construction issue, which is what this is. If you look at the plain meaning of the statute, it says that the debtor the debtor, except in a case in which the debtor is an individual, the debtor may retain property included in the estate under Section 1115. So let's look at 1115. 1115 includes in the estate 541 property and these two categories of after-acquired property.
Now that raises the question that comes up in every one of these cases. 541 already includes pre-petition property, but it just doesn't make sense in trying to apply a plain meaning rule that you would re-include property that's already part of the estate.
Well, I think if you look at what the word include means, it's construed, defined in the bankruptcy code as being expansive, as not limiting. And so I think if you look at it that way, it, you know, includes means all of these things are included.
Well, it can. I mean, that's one thing
right.
It can mean.
Right. And I think, so then the question is, does it make sense? Right? Does that analysis make sense when you look at the whole structure of the bankruptcy code and the BAP-CIPA amendments? And if you look at what Congress did.
So are we now moving away from plain meaning?
No.
Well, it seems to me as though if you have to go to what makes sense in the context of the BAP-CIPA provisions, you've moved away from the plain text.
Well, I think when you do a plain meaning analysis, you still need to make sure that, you know, what you're looking at makes sense in the context of the whole statute.
Makes sense or is not absurd?
Not absurd.
Those,
right.
Not necessarily the same thing. But.
True. But you also have to look at the statute as a whole. You're looking at the plain meaning not just of one clause, but of all of it together.
The reason I say that is because the other side says that this doesn't make sense in the context of the amendments to the code, which were intended to be creditor-friendly amendments.
Well, sure. They were intended to be creditor-friendly. But what Congress was trying to do here is make Chapter 11 more like Chapter 13. Why were they doing that? Well, the core of what Congress was doing was saying, if you have income, if you have too much income, you can't file Chapter 7. We're going to impose this means testing on Chapter 7 to curb these perceived abuses. But they didn't change the debt limits for Chapter 13. They could have, they didn't, and I can go into the reasons why that would not have been a complete solution. But so they as part of this package, then they're forcing debtors into the reorganization chapters so that they can pay creditors not just out of what assets they have on the petition date, but out of their future income. Well, then, two things. One, if the absolute priority rule means they can't keep their business property, then that's going to prevent them from making that future income that the creditors are relying on. Number two, if...
Contrast that, in making that point, contrast a Chapter 11 or a 13, since part of your argument is that there's an assimilation between the two. Contrast the Chapter 11 and a Chapter 13 before and after the amendments in the case where you have a debtor who can't pay their bills but has substantial unencumbered property. What happens in your viewpoint in both the pre and post worlds?
Okay. In a Chapter 13, if they have substantial unencumbered property, then they need to pay the liquidation value of that property into the plan. That's true now, that's true then. In a Chapter 11, that's still true. That protection of that unencumbered property, if there's value there, if there's equity in that property, they need to pay to the unsecured creditors at least what they would get in a Chapter 7. That protection has never been removed. But what they're doing now is saying if you have income on top of that, that income has to be paid into the plan. So we want to encourage reorganizations. Move people out of the liquidation to reorganization. Well, if you're going to do that, you have to make the reorganization possible. And that's why they removed the absolute priority rule with regard to the equity interests of the debtor in their own property.
But if in fact that is what was intended, there are any number of infinitely simpler ways to do it. And look, I'd like to go back to the plain language, which I thought was where we had started.
Right.
And then there are a lot of pieces to this. It seems to me that an equally plausible plain reading is that these confirmation, that this provision can be read as referencing the property in 541. In addition to that property is sort of the signpost pointing to what was included in the bankruptcy estate, confirming that 541 still applies, but reading it alongside 115 to include in the estate only the property specified under subsections 1 and 2. It seems to me that that's an equally plausible, plain language meaning. And if you can't rely on a plain, if your position extends beyond a plain language meaning, then you run into some pretty strong rules of statutory construction about repeals by implication.
Well, I don't think it's a repeal by implication here.
That goes back to whether it's plain meaning, doesn't it?
No, because I think, again, I think the for the reasons stated in Freedman, I think the plain meaning does cover this. And
but if it's not a plain meaning, then your position has to be it's repealed by implication.
No, I don't think it's repealed by implication at all. I think when you look at the whole, even if it's not plain meaning, even if you then have to go look at the reasons and what Congress was doing here and why. The changes here to individual Chapter 11s were really a sea change. And so I don't think, you know, you're looking at this, you know, well, it was pre-act, pre...
Well, they certainly were a sea change, but I don't think you would suggest, would you, that they were a sea change in the direction of easing restrictions on debtors. I mean, the straight, a perfectly straightforward reading, it seems to me, is that it is that the revisions preserve the absolute priority rule as it was pre-BAPSEPA, which would be consistent with Congress's purpose of curbing abuses of the bankruptcy process.
All right. I'm out of time, but I would like to answer that question,
yes,
if I may.
Yes, please do.
I think the reason, yes, BAPSEPA was intended to curb abuses and, in some respects, make it harder on debtors. But to do that, you have to force people into the reorganization chapters and make those chapters work. Because if it doesn't work, you just force them back into Chapter 7, and then all they get, all the creditors get, is the liquidation value. So by repealing the absolute priority rule, you're making the reorganization possible so that the creditors do get the benefit of that disposable income for 5 years.
And Mr. Press, you have some time.
If I could ask him.
Oh, sure, of course.
Just obviously we want to work from the plain meaning of the statute or some canon of construction that allows us to use it. But it just seems particularly odd here that a rule that's been around as long as the absolute priority rule would be changed when there's nothing in the committee reports, nothing in the legislative history that talks about that.
And add to that, nothing in Section 541.
Well, they didn't amend 541, not with regard to any relevant issues here. They amended.
You're adding to 541, aren't you? Isn't that your interpretation?
Well, that's in 1115.
That's what I mean. You're adding to 541, which defines the estate in a section that deals with confirmation.
No. Section 1115 doesn't deal with confirmation. Section 1115 deals with what is property of the estate in a Chapter 11.
Right. Okay.
And it mirrors 1306 in Chapter 13. So all they did is they took the Chapter 13 language and put it in Chapter 11 where it hadn't been before.
Okay.
So that, you know, shows, I think, that they were trying to incorporate those Chapter 13 concepts and get away from these older Chapter 11 concepts.
But I'm sorry, I interrupted your response to Judge Agee.
Yeah. I'm happy to stay up here as long as you want.
Well, let me ask you one more question. This is sort of replowing some of the ground we went through, but the dissent in the Friedman case, mm-hmm. I thought, made the point well that had been made in some of the other bankruptcy opinions around the country, that in reading the included language and the in addition to language, it pointed out that using 1115 in the context of adding only to what was already in the estate made some degree of sense, because the items that are added are those that are specifically excluded under 541A6 and A7.
Right.
How do you analyze that?
Well, I don't think, number one, I don't think it makes sense. And the reason is you're already...
Now, which part doesn't make sense?
What doesn't make sense is to read the included language as only referring to the added. If Congress meant to say added, they would have said added. But 1129B2B2 says included.
I would.
And
it's frightening to try to determine what Congress might have said, because if Congress wanted to repeal the absolute priority rule, I can personally think of two dozen ways that it could have been made clearer.
There's two of them that have been suggested in the cases, and if I may, let me address those. One of them is to say, okay, we're just going to raise the debt limits of Chapter 13, but the problem with that is we still want to provide the protections to creditors in an 11, such as the 1111B elections, the right to treat your secured claim as fully secured, and the right to vote. And then the other one, the other protection is, well, basically the right to vote, that the you know, the suggestion in Friedman in the dissent that it takes away, and in Gebag Debo, that it takes away the right to vote, is just really, I think that's spurious, because the vote's still there, and you still need to have an accepting class. And if they don't accept it, you still need to show that it's fair and equitable, under at least the general fair and equitable standards. So those provisions are still there, and the vote still matters.
And Mr. Press, I think you're beyond responding.
Beyond.
To Judge Agee, and you have some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Schmidt?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ann Schmidt, I represent Ganesh and Veena Maharaj, who were the debtors in the bankruptcy case and the appellants here. Your Honor, our brief did not really focus very much on the plain wording. We dealt more with the possibility that the court would see this as an ambiguous statute. That was not something I necessarily wanted to do, but I sort of conceded that we wouldn't have this many decisions falling all over the map if it were clear as it could be. And I think for purposes of this piece of the discussion, I'm going to address that. Mr. Press has dealt with the plain meaning. The court amicus brief has said that the court, if it is ambiguous, and we're talking about the combination between 1122 and 115, the court should interpret the language in a way that avoids irreconcilable differences between the sections, and also that's consistent with the bankruptcy code as a whole. So let's go back now to the means test, which, because we're looking at a consumer statute or a consumer case here, that's really the heart of the BASIPA changes. There were lots of others, but this was what drove the consumer section. If an individual makes more than the median income for a family of his size in the state where they live, Chapter 7 may not be an option. It is admittedly a little more nuanced than that, but that's the heart of it. Instead, the court may dismiss that case or, with the consent of the debtor, convert it to a 13 or a 7. That works really well if we're talking about a 13. It works so well in an 11. 11 really was designed for a corporation. It is an exceptionally awkward fit for an individual. That was, of course, truer pre-BAPSIPA than it is now. Congress addressed that problem, because there were debt limits in the 13, with a comprehensive and integrated set of amendments that picked up and dropped a lot of the Chapter 13 language right into Chapter 11. It's some of this that we're dealing with today, because these two statutes, or certainly 1115, mirrors 1306, and we're seeing this back and forth. Sometimes they got it right, sometimes it's a little sloppy. There are two sections that came in those changes that I think make it important that the absolute priority rule be seen as abrogated for individual cases only in terms of the debtor retaining property. One of those is 1123A8. That says, and it's a mandatory part of that statute, that the debtor must commit future income to the payment of plan debt. The second is 1129A15, the projected disposable income rule. Those two are more or less mandatory. If the absolute priority rule applies, and we're talking about an individual who has his own business, and that really is the bulk of what we're talking about in these individual Chapter 11 cases, you've now got a situation where this debtor can't keep any property, which includes things like his car, but also his business, the source of funding under the plan, where you have mandated provisions that say future revenues need to be committed to the plan. It just doesn't work. It is irreconcilable. And that's why I think the court, even if you'd find that this is not clear language, that it is ambiguous, this is the only way you have to go.
What about the notion that perhaps a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, that you want to deal with the assets that you have on hand and protect the creditors that way?
And of course, that's always been the case. One of the things that we tend to forget, because fair and equitable in terms of the absolute priority rule has become a shorthand over the years, but fair and equitable includes this whole concept of absolute priority. It isn't limited to absolute priority. The code doesn't say fair and equitable means. It says fair and equitable includes. So the court retains not only the ability, but I would suggest the duty to look at these things in an overall context, the context of plain meaning. You know, is this fair and equitable? Are the creditors getting what they are entitled to get? If I propose a plan that pays you 80 cents and the last 79 cents comes in year 10, I don't think that's fair and equitable, even though it may meet all the other requirements. Similarly, although I get to keep my after-acquired property, I think a judge would be hard-pressed to say, you bought that lottery ticket post-petition and you're now the winner of $265 million, but you don't have to commit any of that to the plan.
Well, wouldn't it be up to the debtor in Chapter 11, the debtor in possession, to go to the creditors and say, here's my plan for paying you out. In order to make this plan work and pay you more than you would get if I was in the Chapter 7 today, I need to keep my business property. And if they can't make that as a convincing argument to the creditors, why should they be able to keep it?
The argument, and you see it in a lot of these cases, that you really just need to sweeten the pot and you'll get the votes, works well in a corporate context. In a corporate context, you deal with an unsecured creditors committee. That's where the negotiation happens. Or you deal with the one or maybe two creditors that are probably responsible for you being in there to begin with. On a consumer side, to pick up the phone and negotiate with six credit companies and three mortgage companies is just about impossible. That's the practical reality of these cases. The other practical reality is that creditors don't vote. Apathy is a really big problem in these Chapter 11 cases. This case, we have $3.4 million worth of unsecured debt. The facts are kind of strange in terms of how that got there. One creditor voted, Discover Card, with a $10,000 claim. Two of the other creditors were in the courtroom, didn't vote and didn't object. They just sat there. It's an extremely difficult process on the consumer side, actually negotiating your way through.
But it's not so much in that context a consumer bankruptcy as it is, I would think, in the context of the sole proprietor, that they're operating the business that's to generate the disposable income as opposed to a wage earner in a Chapter 13.
It's true, but what you're really talking about is the source of the income, not the character of the creditors. And I think that's the difference. It's critical that I keep my job or I can't make payments, but convincing Capital One of that it may just simply be on the scope of reality. I am out of time, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. You have rebuttal as well. Is it Ms. Sangvi?
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court, Neelam Sangvi on behalf of court-assigned amicus counsel. Debtors here just can't meet their burden of showing that Congress abrogated the absolute priority rule in BAPSIPA, as I think the majority decision in the Friedman case and the other cases that adopt the so-called broad view show. You have to read the statutory provisions at issue in what the Stat Court described as a really convoluted manner to reach that result, and that just is a violation of the clear statement rule. If there's no clear statement, we can't find abrogation here.
You said a clear statement?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just didn't understand what you said, that's why.
A clear statement, yes.
And so you take issue with the characters, the plain language argument?
We do. The plain language argument that the Friedman majority adopted and that's been advanced, particularly in the NACPA brief in this case, simply doesn't work. First, it seems to rest largely on the notion that includes is not a word of limitation. And as Your Honor pointed out, while that's true in some contexts, it's not how the statute is written here. Includes is used in very specific ways in 1129 B2B2 and also in 1115 to introduce specific statutory provisions and items of property. It's not introducing an illustrative list of examples. The other problem is that the reading on the debtor's side that they call plain language leads to a lot of surplusage problems. If 1115 really does fully define the individual debtor's estate, as they say it does, if you look at the language that Congress added to BAPSIPA in 1129B2B2, they could have just said that, except that in a case in which the debtor is an individual, the debtor may retain property included in the estate, full stop. They wouldn't have had to include this reference to under Section 1115. And I think there's other problems, too, as the dissent in Freedom and the Gabdebo, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, court noted, the voting process does become quite odd.
In the Friedman case, as I understand their rejoinder to that argument, it's that Section 1306 has the same language in a Chapter 13, and according to them, nobody's ever challenged that.
Well, I think the difference is that 1306 and Chapter 13 in general doesn't have an absolute priority rule, so this issue of what does under 1306 mean, or in this case, under Section 1115, simply
identical language.
It is identical language, but my point is that there's never been a need to really interpret, does Section 1306 bring in all of 541 and now completely define the individual debtor's estate, because there's no sort of corollary to the absolute priority rule that would provoke the discussion that we're having here today. And I think that if you look at the way that the Friedman majority paraphrased what it thinks Section 1115 is doing, if you look at page 19 of that decision, they paraphrase 1115 as including three types of property, and they set it out as a numbered list. Number one, 541 property. Number two, the post-petition property. And number three, the post-petition earnings. But that's inconsistent with the structure of the statute as written. 541 is not an enumerated subsection within 1115. It's in just part of a reference and a prefatory phrase to that section that introduces what's going on here and points out that 1115 is adding or including the specific types of property specified in the subsection.
Well, what was the purpose then of referencing 541 in that provision?
Well, as we set out in our brief, in our view, it really is a signpost to say, look, this new 1115 adds to 541, but it does not subsume it. It's part of the prefatory introduction, and it doesn't do substantive work in terms of bringing property in, but it is a reminder that 541 is not being supplanted in individual cases. And as I believe the Gadebo Court and some of the others that have adopted the so-called...
Why would that make sense, though? Because 541 already is made inclusive by 103. Why would they need to add this additional phrase in 1115?
There's sort of an oddity in that the caption of 1115 says property of the estate. So as Gabdebo and some of the other courts adopting the so-called narrow view have noted, an argument could have been made if this in addition to phrase wasn't included, that individual debtors' estates no longer included the 541 property. So this is really a clarification. And it makes sense if you look at what Congress was really doing in BAPSIPA. The real change here is not the amendment to 1129B2B2. The real substantive change is bringing in post-petition property and earnings into an individual debtor's estate where they simply weren't included before. When you look at it that way, as the Karlovich Court and some of the other bankruptcy courts have pointed out, what was happening in this corresponding amendment to the absolute priority rule in 1129B2B2 was really a cleanup and a clarification to say that even if the absolute priority rule is triggered, you can still keep these post-petition property and earnings. They're now part of your state, but were not before BAPSIPA.
What's the basis, just as a general principle, and Ms. Schmidt made this argument, for distinguishing between Chapter 11 individual debtors and Chapter 13 individual debtors with respect to the absolute priority rule? Why make that distinction?
In other words, why not read these changes as making this? I think that, so the Friedman majority and Ms. Schmidt and a lot of authorities on the debtor's side say that, well, if Congress brought all of these Chapter 13 provisions into Chapter 11, they must have basically wanted to make this just like Chapter 13 for individual debtors. But I would submit that the more reasonable inference is that Congress really wanted to maintain the separation between the two chapters and keep creditor protections and also debtor benefits in Chapter 11 intact. So a debtor can benefit by being in Chapter 11 because they remain in possession. They can continue to operate their business. That doesn't, there's no trustee as there is in Chapter 13. The creditor protections are, among other things, the absolute priority rule. And so I think it would be odd to say that we're bringing things into Chapter 11 for no reason, essentially. You could just raise the debt limits. I think what Mr. Press pointed out is that one of the protections that's maintained for creditors in Chapter 11 is the voting process. But if you read the absolute priority rule as being eliminated in individual Chapter 11 cases, the voting process really has no meaning. It makes cram down virtually automatic, except in the rare case where a court might look, you know, fall back on its sort of background ability to look at the equities. But we have congressionally defined equities here, and so we can't just ignore those in these types of cases.
But isn't the ultimate creditor protection in this case the bankruptcy judge who, if push comes to shove, as Ms. Schmidt argued, can simply decline to approve the plan?
It is true that there's that background power, but I don't think that the fact that some residual power, and it's not clear how often it's exercised, exists as a reason to read out the very specific protections that Congress put in place. And I think the majority in Friedman tried to get around this problem where the votes don't really matter anymore by saying, well, if there are rejecting votes, those creditors will also have objected, and so they'll trigger this new projected disposable income test, and they'll still have some protection. But that's not true. That's not what happened here. Discover voted no. No one else in the unsecured class voted at all. But there was no objection filed, so the projected disposable income test wasn't triggered here. So saying that that is mandatory or that it is triggered by a no vote, so your no vote still counts, ignores the sort of mechanisms by which these different creditor protections work in the statute. And I think at the end of the day, as Judge Duncan noted, at best you may have two plausible readings of these statutory provisions. And that's precisely where the presumptions that we laid out in our brief kick in. Especially in the world of bankruptcy practice, the Supreme Court has been quite clear you cannot change a past bankruptcy practice without a clear statement from Congress. If there's two equally plausible readings of the statute, that's not a clear statement. If we look at the legislative history, there's also no clear statement there. Where Congress was changing things in BAPSIPA, it discussed that in the legislative history. The means test was a major change. It's discussed at length in the House report. There's no discussion of elimination of the absolute priority rule, which debtors concede is a significant change in practice. There's also a part of the House report that specifically lists out the debtor protections that were enacted in BAPSIPA. This would be a significant debtor protection if it had happened. Again, abrogation of the absolute priority rule is not listed there.
What do you say to Ms. Schmidt's argument, which is more, I guess, of the practical day-to-day practitioner's argument, that if you adopt the dissent's Friedman, that it makes it practically very difficult to have an individual Chapter 11 because you can't get the creditors to vote, and it's a different type of, it's more like trying to get the Chapter 13 creditors to vote almost.
I think there's a few responses to that.
That's just the way it is.
Well, that is certainly one response. That's just the way it is. I think those arguments were made in individual Chapter 11 cases before BAPSIPA. Congress was presumably aware of that law. It didn't clearly change it. And also, from a practical perspective, I don't know that it's as difficult as has been portrayed. There are several bankruptcy courts that presumably see these cases all the time and still have held that Congress didn't abrogate the absolute priority rule, so it doesn't seem like they think that this is going to pose huge practical problems, or if it is, it's consistent with what Congress was doing here. But I also think on a practical level, if you look at sort of the procedural history and how some of these cases where the APR has been applied to individual debtors post-BEPSIPA have played out, you can see that liquidation is not always what happens. In the Drayman case, for example, where the court adopted the narrow view, the debtor was able to come up with new value, a contribution from a third-party business associate, and satisfy the rule that way. In the Karlovich and Stevens cases, there's two Stevens cases, so in the one out of the Southern District of Texas, the debtors in those cases were able to file amended plans and get creditor acceptances, and we cited those documents in our brief. So I think that as a practical matter, it may be the case that negotiation might not work in some specific cases, but it certainly can work. And that's the structure of Chapter 11 as a whole, and what it's intended to do is to provide different parties in the Chapter 11 process with different leverage tools to provoke those negotiations. So here, for instance, in rejecting the plan, Discover Card and the others in the unsecured creditor class weren't necessarily saying, we want you to liquidate their business. They're saying, come back to the negotiating table. Let's see what else we can do here. I think that what the bankruptcy court described as a token payment to Discover Card works out to about $184. It's 1.7% of their claim over 5 years. But the Maharajas here are keeping pre-petition assets that go beyond just their business. They've indicated in their brief that there's a $26 annuity that they're willing to put into the plan if necessary. So it could be that in a negotiation, that might satisfy the unsecured creditors. So I think that to say that this necessarily leads to liquidation and that negotiation never works doesn't, it may be true, but I don't think it's always true. And at the end of the day, this is, again, difficulties that Congress was aware of at the time BAPSIPA was enacted. And it simply made no clear statement that it wanted to change the state of affairs. In fact, it put more people, individuals, into Chapter 11 than otherwise would have been there. So I think that overall, the plain language of the statutes doesn't support the debtor's reading. I think it supports our reading that the absolute priority rule has been preserved in the same form that it's always applied to individual debtors. And I think at the bottom, you just don't have a clear statement of any intent to repeal. And in the absence of that, there's, I don't think, any way to hold that the absolute priority rule actually has been repealed.
Are those two statements consistent? You said the plain meaning of the statute supports your position, but in the absence of that, there's nothing in the language that supports repeal by implication. That seems to be inconsistent. Well, your argument was that the statute is not plain.
Our argument, we believe that the reading of the statute that's the most reasonable on the plain language and doesn't create the surplusage problems that the debtor's reading does, is that the statute operates to preserve the absolute priority rule. But even if you don't think that that's plain, our sort of backup argument is that if you have two reasonable interpretations, one on either side, that's when a clear statement is required, and that's what we simply don't have. If you've found that the statute's not plain, we don't have it in the text. And we certainly also don't have it in the legislative history.
Which is, in fact, a mirror of the debtor's argument that it's plain.
Yes.
But if we don't think it's plain, then there are other reasons to.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if it's not plain, I think there simply has to be a clear statement. The Supreme Court's been very clear on that point. And the presumption makes sense when you're dealing with the bankruptcy code, because all sorts of financial decisions are sort of made on reliance. What's going on with these different rules. So if they could be changed without a particularly clear statement from Congress, it would make them unreliable, and that's sort of something we wouldn't want, I would imagine, in the bankruptcy context in particular. And that's, so the presumptions aren't just technicalities. I think they really do have important meaning here. There are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Press?
Thank you. Just a couple things briefly. I think this idea that, you can keep just the added property, just the post-petition assets, you know, that just doesn't make sense, because if you look at 1129A15 and 1123A8, you got to contribute those to the plan anyway. So the idea that that it's saying that you can keep those just doesn't make sense.
My concern, picking up on a point that I think Judge Diaz raised and Ms. Sangvi was mentioning, is that this rule has been a mainstay of Chapter 11 for a very long time. And it is, as the debtors recognize here, a sea change. When you have a sea change when you have a change of this magnitude, wouldn't we expect to have some recognition of the fact? The as I understand it, Congress repealed the absolute priority once and made its intent clear in both the text and through legislative history.
And we have nothing of the kind here supporting what would make for a watershed change in bankruptcy law, would it not?
Well, I think when you look at the package of amendments that was made at the same time, I think it becomes clear that this, you know, this is not a repeal by implication. I mean, this is a clear overhaul of this part of Chapter 11. But let me point out something. When Congress repealed it before, they repealed the entire absolute priority rule as to all Chapter 11s. All right, here we have even as to individuals, it's not repealed completely. And the reason is you have different levels of general and subordinated debt. Priority claims have to be paid in full anyway. But you can have general and subordinated debt. The code subordinates punitive damages and penalties and this sort of thing. If the absolute priority rule clearly still applies to that in individual cases. So you still have to pay your general unsecured creditors in full before you can pay your subordinated creditors. All they did here is take the next step away, which is this equity interest, which, you know, frankly, never made sense as to individuals anyway, saying you had equity in your own stuff. It doesn't really fit with the concept of equity as in the shareholders' equity in a corporation. And so they kind of just, I think, got rid of that aspect of Ollers and said, okay, you know, the absolute priority rule doesn't make sense. New value doesn't make sense anymore because you can't have the post-petition earnings that you would normally contribute as new value because those already have to go to the plan. So you have to get rid of it. I think that's what they did. Thank you.
Ms. Schmidt?
And I'm going to raise one other issue in the context of the sea change that we're talking about here. The absolute priority rule actually made a little more sense pre-BEPSIPA because debtors always had the ability to file a Chapter 7. They kind of toss everything in. And in that sense, if I'm a dentist and have my own practice, I probably get to keep my practice because it isn't worth anything unless I'm working in it. 707 changed that. It changed it probably as dramatically as anything in the code with the BEPSIPA changes. Again, an integrated package of changes. So that now, I may not have the option of filing a Chapter 7. Instead, I file a Chapter 11. But does that then mean I need to go through a meaningless, futile, and very expensive exercise to get to the point where it's now clear I can't get a plan confirmed because I can't pay my creditors enough that they're going to accept this, and I have to keep my business because it's the only way I could do a plan? That doesn't make any sense to me. And I think you get around that problem and around 1113 or 1123 and around the projected disposable income test by saying, in this very narrow context, an individual, that part of fair and equitable that's always been defined as the absolute priority rule no longer applies. You get to keep your property. It doesn't let you out of a fair and equitable analysis. The court still does that. So I vote, and I've got a class that says no, but I want to cram down. That forces us into an 1129B analysis. The court is then required to take a look to see whether things are fair and equitable. The difference is that part of that analysis no longer is, and you don't get to keep your house, and you don't get to keep your business. Instead, you've got to give your creditors that value, but that business is allowed to be kept in order to provide the funding for the plan. I think that all holds together very well. And it's consistent with Chapter 13, consistent with all those layered changes that got put onto Chapter 11.
Thank you very much. I would like to take this opportunity to thank Ms. Sangvi and the members of the Georgetown University Law Center for undertaking this court-assigned amicus project. We very much appreciate your guidance to the court. We will come down and greet counsel, take a brief recess.
This honorable court will take a brief recess.